We thought long and hard about what to effectively launch the science fiction podcast series to accompany our screenings with, and in the end we decided to go for this 1976 classic Logan's Run, regarded by many people as a minor classic of pre-Star Wars 1970s science fiction. Logan's Run has shown surprising longevity, widespread appeal, laying in a core concept that effectively pitches 1984's Man Against the Dystopian State conflict within a classic chase movie. That's the kind of top rider, but to address that, as is very much par for the course with these podcast companions, we're delighted to be able to welcome ace director of a whole heap of other goodies in terms of speculative fiction, the movie world, and more. Of course, co-host of the fabulous weekly Chill Pack Hollywood Scenario, amongst other things, Spectres, The Truth Is Out There, and a heap of other things. Phil Leonis, welcome to the first official podcast companion in this selection of movie masterclass. We still haven't come up with a name, but I'm sure we'll get that sorted out before too long.
It's a thrill to be participating in this, and of course, as memory serves, you and I first became acquainted at Sci-Fi London, a fantastic annual event that celebrates the best in speculative fiction as depicted on screen each and every year.
Very much so, and indeed Louis Savvy will hopefully be joining us to share his thoughts and reflections on some of the movies in the series. Logan's Run, 1967 was when it was originally written by William F. Nolan, and indeed George Clayton Johnson, known for work in the Star Trek and Twilight Zone scenario. The book, of course, tells of the totalitarian future in which youth has proliferated to the point where society decides that euthanasia will be enforced at the age of 21, something, as we'll see, that the movie actually delays a couple of changes with, possibly to accommodate Michael York. When each individual reaches last day, revealed by the colour of a flower-shaped crystal embedded into one of their palms, they happily trot along to a sleep shop where they are painlessly executed by poison gas. Changes as ever made in the 1976 film adaptation. Michael Anderson, of course, a director who has quite a pedigree when it comes to science fiction films himself.
Well, I mean, Michael Anderson, probably most famous for directing the Oscar-winning Around the World in 80 Days.
Jules Verne is science fiction.
And it's interesting to view these, not that that was his first film and not that Logan's Run is his last film, but it is interesting to view them as kind of the polar opposites of his career, where Around the World in 80 Days garnered such acclaim and popularity upon its release. But history has not been kind to it. It generally goes down as one of, if not the worst, one of the worst Oscar-winning films of all time. And yet, as you alluded, Logan's Run, which did receive, you know, a sizable box office share when it was released, was nevertheless discarded by most critics and the media at the time it was released. But it has stood the test of time. It has proven to capture the imagination. So it really is kind of an interesting mirror image for Michael Anderson's career.
Speaking as a science fiction aficionado, Phil, and somebody who is sufficiently chronologically gifted to remember the era as a teenager, and obviously the pre...
Oh, yes, I'm closer to renewing for my second time than for my first time.
I think that's applying to both of us in this particular instance. The thing that really appeals to me was it actually was part of a whole crop of movies which possibly got their start maybe back with Planet of the Apes and then 2001, which actually seems to take seriously science fiction concepts and really kind of make the audience think. And I actually went to see it with my mother at the time. She was still my mother, of course, now. I wasn't just the mother at the time. I wasn't someone I borrowed. So it's an old one. I thought the juxtaposition...
Mother? What's that?
Exactly. And the way in which the characterizations of Logan 5 and Jessica 7 were portrayed by Michael York and, of course, Jenny Agutter, they were pretty sexy actors. They worked in their own way. And Peter Ustinov, actually, I thought was superbly cast in retrospect as the old man. I mean, we're not giving plot details here, and people can choose to listen to these podcasts before they see the movie, obviously, as well as hopefully listening to them again after the movie to maybe sort of pick up on some of the things.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there will be some spoilers in this conversation because I do think that Logan's Run, for how much it has been dismissed upon first viewing by so many as being quote-unquote silly, it has very serious ideas in its mind. And so instead of lumping it in with Planet of the Apes or even the thoughtful, cautionary, dystopian science fiction films of the 70s, all of which from a financial standpoint were trying to recapture the audience that 2001 and Planet of the Apes proved was out there, an audience hungry for serious science fiction. I do believe when you mentioned 1967 and the year 1976, this is a film that is intentionally responding to certain ideas expressed in Star Trek and is anticipating what George Lucas would do with Star Wars, namely breathing life back into classic and universal myths and archetypes to make them resonate with contemporary audiences. Now, it might not have done so nearly as effectively in terms of, again, popular culture success as Star Wars, but it quite successfully, I believe, argues the danger of what Star Wars' very success would wreak upon culture. So it really does stand alone, and I think it's a very interesting choice for you to include in this series, because it really, while being an incredibly fun film and something that all ages seem to be able to enjoy, it also has a lot to say about not only the culture of the time and the issues that the world was facing, especially America was facing, but where our culture was heading.
It has to be said from a fan perspective as well. It was with great excitement. I still remember the tangible joy when I was visiting, I think, a couple of science fiction stores in both Edinburgh and London. One, I think, might have been Dark They Were in Golden-Eyed in London, and it might have been a Forbidden Planet store as well that was actually there. And I could actually pick up the paperback sequels Logan's World and indeed Logan's Search, together, of course, with the short-lived Marvel comic series at the time. And needless to say, yes, I will say I was also a fan of the TV series. And as you rightly said, drawing the Star Trek parallel, many of those episodes were written by DC Fontana, again keeping the Star Trek link going.
Although
Gregory Harrison and Heather Menzies were, they did it again. And of course, we had Donald Moffat as Rem, their companion.
And perhaps you are correct that the changing of the age from the novel, where it's 21 and over, or at age 21 you have to go to Carousel, to 30, perhaps that was a product of who they wished to cast. Nevertheless, there can be no denying that making it be 30 opened up this world of mythology and especially religious iconography that is so prevalent throughout Logan's Run. It opened it up as available in a way that it would not have been if the age was 21. But first, you know, it's amazing, you know, is the fact that it was first written in 1967 and at all a coincidence then when the movie begins with the title crawl that tells you that this is taking place in the 23rd century, right? What other science fiction work that launched right around 1967 introduces us to the 23rd century? It's Star Trek, and indeed that can't be any coincidence, because this film is so often an alternative to how Star Trek looked at where our culture seemed to be heading if you looked at the most idealistic parts of the Kennedy era 1960s. Mm. And Logan's Run looks at where our culture might be heading if you look at some of the more disturbing aspects of our 1970s culture.
As the narrative proceeded, and I can always, obviously, like yourself, I rewatched it recently, and it brings back, as with all these wonderful artifacts, you do a bit of time travelling yourself in the sense of time travelling through mind, just as any good novel will take you back over certain experiences and so on, and slices of your own reality interface with what you're reading or indeed watching. But I do remember, well, so far so good. It's obviously a supermarket shopping centre. It's a consumer-based culture. We had the renewal scenario. But for me, one of the most effective aspects of it was when you had the two characters of Logan and Jessica emerging into the sunlight, and actually they didn't have what I kind of was fearing they might do at the time, and, oh, everything's wonderful, we're in the Garden of Eden, it's paradise, it's okay. Actually, they really didn't like it. They really did
No. Yes,
like
this is a film, thematically, this is a film thematically that argues that freedom, that life is probably without meaning unless it is accompanied by freedom, but freedom itself is pain. And so then that leads you right back to the idea that life itself is pain, and that's where the meaning of it is. And but, you know, I liked what you said about how, look, movies are, to a degree, time machines, right? Not only do they transport us to different times and different places, but they transport us back to who we were at different points. And this is a movie that is very tricky because it argues, again, about the culture, the banal culture of arrested adolescence that Star Wars, to a large degree, would create. An entire culture on arrested adolescence would grow up around these mythologies that George Lucas authored. And Logan's Run tells us what might happen if we actually embrace such a culture. But at the same time, when you go back to look at Logan's Run, you aren't watching it as a child now. Rather, you're watching it as an adult, and those first shots you see are these model shots, and they're model shots that not only don't look photorealistic, they're not intended to look photorealistic. And so the adult in you is saying, wow, why did I like this when I was younger? And then you immediately realize, right, because kids love models. We love them. They are in that dreamlike world we live in when we're children. They, models, really harness our fantasy, our dreams. And so it's an announcement, a wonderful announcement at the beginning of this film that this story is going to unfold in a dreamlike, you know, scape. Mm. And so you can follow the story of the characters, attractive as they are. You can dismiss it as silly if you want to, the same way some people will dismiss their own dreams as being silly. It's just a dream. But if you want to, you can really enjoy the symbolic underpinnings of everything that takes place in this movie and find delight and find meaning and find inspiration throughout this film.
The writer Matt Bielby, who amongst other things has edited SFX magazine and indeed the short-lived Death Ray magazine, writing in a wonderful feature for Sci-Fi Chronicles produced by Guy Haley. Two interesting things he draws attention to. First of all, the fact that most of the film was actually shot in what was then a brand new Dallas shopping centre, which was a relatively unknown environment. Ooh, it's a shopping mall and so on. And in fact that the gun that the Sandmen fire was very much based on Judge Dredd's Lawgiver. And Judge Dredd, obviously, very much a character of British comics who emerged in all sorts of ways, that you had that notion of the law and the Sandmen, as, again, the other allusion to sleep, that, you know, if you send for Mr. Sandman, and Mr. Sandman, send me a dream, etc., that very notion of the Sandmen as the law enforcers probably, again, reinforced that notion of sending people to sleep, or indeed, you know, just basically mopping them up nicely. And wasn't it nice to have those wonderful clean-up jobs of how they actually used acid or some such stuff to simply wipe away the stain of a life of somebody who was effectively...
The messiness of life, the messiness of organic life. Mm. Yeah, you know, the Sandmen throughout mythology are the guardians of good dreams. So if they are the guardians of good dreams, then what that means is that seeking freedom, seeking to break the rules, is literally the nightmare of revolt that they are guarding against. They are protecting the dreamlike state of this world. And yes, it's so much fun to watch this movie and to see the way that, again, on the surface almost, it's dealing with contemporary cultural issues of the time. You mentioned the shopping malls, the consumer culture that was exploding, shopping mall culture of the 1970s. You're dealing with the death penalty. You're dealing with abortion. you're dealing with feminism, all of these hot button issues that were really coming to the fore in the 1970s, while at the same time you have everywhere you look these mythological symbols. You've got the Capricorns being called to carousel, so we know that zodiacal symbols are in play. We've already mentioned dream symbols.
It was certainly
the carousel itself,
and the classic one, which was certainly my first interpretation of the whole thing, the Egyptian symbol of life, the Ankh, A-N-K-H.
The Ankh. Well, you're jumping ahead a little bit. You're seeking sanctuary from this conversation, but there is no sanctuary, my friend. Carousel.
In the books, it has to be said that sanctuary was revealed to be located on Mars in Logan's World and Logan's Search, which I thought was quite interesting in terms of, obviously, from the movie's perspective, and that's pretty much what we are considering, it was actually shown simply to be a mythology, just pure myth.
And I would say that that's the same thing, because if we were to interpret again symbolically and through dream, the idea that sanctuary is on Mars means that the concept of sanctuary is truly alien to this world, that it does not exist in a human life on Earth. There is no sanctuary. Life is pain. But this carousel symbol is wonderful. It's very evocative of the Tarot archetype. So we've already had dreams. We've had, you know, Jungian symbols. We've had zodiacal symbols. And now we introduce the Tarot archetype, the Wheel of Fortune. And, you know, most people today only think of the Tarot as something, well, you get your fortunes read, right, with these cards. But that was never the idea. The idea was that these major arcana of the Tarot represent the 22 fundamental energies that make up all of life, that comprise all of us. And depending on what cards you pull, you realize what energy either you are living through or what energy you would be wise to try to embody to a better degree. And the energetic of the Wheel of Fortune, the carousel, is literally the gateway of the soul. That's how it's called. It's represented by all celestial phenomenon, many of which are on exhibit there in the carousel while the renewal is taking place, controlling the flow of blood, riches, and poverty. The purpose of the Wheel of Fortune is to prevent the worlds from flying apart, and isn't that the function that the carousel serves? It's absolutely essential to keep the world of Logan's Run spinning.
You mentioned, Phil, about the feminist movement and, of course, the liberation theology, which started in the 60s and obviously developed and clearly, you know, a long history with respect to that whole struggle and challenge within that. It's interesting that the dominant voice that we hear, the voice of the computer, is quite clearly feminine in terms of the assigning to Logan of the task of locating sanctuary, the robbing him of the last years of his life, etc., and that kind of interesting line that we see there. And obviously the character that we're first introduced to of Jessica is seen as somebody who's effectively, we suppose, from the viewer's perspective, gone on this carousel. It's almost a transporter-like technology. I mean, that was one of the areas which I did feel, yes, if you see it as a dream, it does connect from that point of view, but there isn't a sort of sense of, well, you simply actually hook up to your latest contact scenario and then choose the people you wish to actually sort of be with when they go on the circuit.
This film is so prescient. I mean, it presages Tinder, Grindr, yeah, both of them, yeah, right? And you know, your hookup apps of today, your same sex hookup apps of today, and in a wonderfully witty insight, it also reveals what we have found out to be true in this modern internet age of dating sites and hookup apps, namely how many women on these sites actually turn out to be men, pretending to be women, which we find out in Logan's Run is what's happening. So it's wonderfully forward-thinking in terms of where our culture is heading and how technology, of course, already in the 70s, but even more so today, right, new technology is used either in defense, in entertainment, or in sex, in pornography. These are the ways technology tends to get used, because if it can't be used in those ways, there's no way really to monetize it. So Logan's Run is aware of all these things, but with the feminist issue, I think there you brought up really two characters, the character of the computer and, of course, the character played by Jenny Agutter. And the wonderfully ongoing conversation and dance, the romantic courtship that takes place between Logan and Jessica, the theme of which is that assent must constantly be given by the woman, moment by moment. This was, believe it or not, in the 1970s, it's hard to remember, but this was very forward-thinking at that time.
Well,
that only yes meant yes, and that the yes must be granted each and every moment and can be withdrawn each and every moment. It's quite a feminist statement.
And certainly the most explicit example of that is when they finally begin to acknowledge their external life and they dive into the pool, they realise that their life clocks have turned clear, and they still, there's the line that we get from the Jessica character is, I still have the choice, I still can say no. And that's made quite explicit in that. Stay with us, Phil, because we want to take a short sort of brief musical break, I think, because we still need to talk about some of the other iconography that comes through, and of course such questions as Farrah Fawcett, wasn't the character of Holly such a wonderful insertion in her own way, and whether you like Blondes or New You, and of course the aforementioned Peter Ustinov, plus of course the connection between Logan's Run and maybe Planet of the Apes. In fact, I think we'll use it as a bit of background as well, that sort of wonderful, haunting Jerry Goldsmith theme. I hadn't realised that he actually had done the music to Logan's Run until we were checking through his august career, and as well as obviously things like Man from U.N.C.L.E., Star Trek the Motion Picture, Planet of the Apes and so on. I think once more, as with most themes that he'd actually worked with, Jerry Goldsmith produced a tour de force, which was just so, it was expressive and meaningful, and he certainly had the magic, I think, in terms of that. I mean, Phil, as a director, if Jerry Goldsmith were alive today from that point of view, I think you'd quite like to work with him, I suspect.
Oh, there was no one better. There was no one better. And underrated in his oeuvre was his love theme. I always wished that he had maybe sat down, as prolific and wonderful as John Williams was, I always wished that maybe he could have taught John Williams a thing or two about love themes. Whether you have Ilia's theme from Star Trek the Motion Picture or the love theme from Chinatown, I believe no one did love themes better than Jerry Goldsmith, at least any composer who was also able to muster those rousing marches the way that Goldsmith was.
In a kind of appreciation and maybe one might say homage, which was echoed in its own way, we had the ending of Planet of the Apes, another movie we'll be considering in this run and series, with, of course, the discovery of Washington and the imagery of old age and the symbol of, obviously, the Abraham Lincoln Memorial. Something else which you could say was also echoed when Tim Burton produced that reimagining of Planet of the Apes. And, of course, instead of the Statue of Liberty, we actually have the iconography of Lincoln again. That I thought worked well. Initially, I had difficulty coming to terms with the Peter Ustinov character, but as perhaps one's become more chronologically gifted, again, there's a poeticism in his approach. And, of course, the fact that he very much starts quoting T.S. Eliot and the McCavity and the Cats long before Andrew Lloyd Webber started work on the Cat scenario and so on. Is that kind of a take on the notion of actually sometimes not only appreciating age, but also appreciating the whole essence of the life experience?
Well, I don't know how to get into the thematic material here. There's so much to deal with. But I think an important moment is when they visit the Lincoln Memorial, and that's the first time they see what an old person would look like before they meet Peter Ustinov. And that's important because here's a president, someone who is not able to achieve that office till 35, 5 years after they're allowed to live in their own life. And we have a rule that you must be older than 30 in order to hold this office, because only with age comes wisdom. But it's not just any president. It's also a president most associated with freeing a populace of people. So this is a movie about enslavement versus freedom. And freedom from what is really the burning question. And I think this goes back to Logan himself. You know, if you look into what the meanings of names are, and I don't think, names are ever chosen coincidentally. Logan literally is a Gaelic name. It derives from Gaelic origin, and it means someone from the Hollow, someone who resides in the Hollow. A Hollow Man is a very interesting and apt analogy. There's something hollow inside Logan at the beginning of this movie, and we see it, right? He's standing at the nursery looking at these babies. He's seeking something. He's seeking something to complete himself. And his adventure begins with the first runner in the movie. And when they kill the first runner, he gets this clue that leads him on his journey. Number 483, New You, Face Change. It's a wonderful contemporary criticism that even in a youth culture where no one lives to be older than 30, that's still too old, and they still have to aspire to be younger. And boy, weren't they reading the writing on the wall of where we were heading culturally, at least in terms of movies. But the number 483, again, not a coincidence. It is a very powerful, what is known as angel number in numerology. It's a number that it assists with requests and prayers, and it tells you that all the financial aspects of your life have been heard and responded to and answered by the angels and the archangels. It's about keeping a positive attitude and consciously manifesting abundance. And indeed, when Logan visits number 483 as a, supposedly a Sandman, he's not there to bring the doctor to any kind of justice or to get him into trouble for helping the runners. Indeed, Logan is really there to be a runner himself. But by denying the calling of this potential assistance, it leads to the doctor's death. So there's this wonderful entrance into the mythological that's tied with our themes about aging that cannot really be separated. And I always go back to again what we were talking about a little bit earlier, the voice of the computer. And the computer introducing the Ankh symbol, the symbol of sanctuary, and giving Logan a specific assignment, which is known as Procedure 033-03. And if we doubt it at any point, the Christian iconography of this movie, boy, it can't get more obvious than 33-3. 33, of course, being the Christ year, 3 being the Holy Trinity, the unification of mind, body, and spirit, a unification that Logan must undergo for himself to be reborn. Now, I'm not saying that, of course, Logan's Run is advocating Christian dogma. What I am saying that in its own way, it's using the mythology, the symbolism, to breathe life back into the mythological underpinnings of that story, where we are all meant to walk that path, where we are all Logan, where we all must be crucified, resurrected, and ultimately ascend, which is the narrative structure of Logan's story in this film.
There's an interesting line as well. If we look at the actor, of course, Michael York, who portrayed John the Baptist in the Jesus of Nazareth TV miniseries, again, this is 1976. He would subsequently go on after Three Musketeers and a variety of other things. Many people now might know him best for being, of course, in the Austin Powers movie or a series of trilogy, Austin Powers work as Austin's boss. But I was also particularly impressed with his role as Andrew Braddock in another movie, which was a contemporary with Rogan, the year after, of course. It was Island of Dr. Moreau. With, of course, Burt Lancaster as Dr. Moreau in the H.G. Wells adaptation, which, of course, we had Richard Basehart, who was the Sayer of the Law. War. It's another movie which we might include in another series, but again, looking towards that, quite interesting seeing the way York's career was developing and going on. There was a time, actually, when I thought he might have made it a reasonable Bond, but I think he'd never quite sort of worked for him from that point of view. He was very much a British actor who kind of made it in Hollywood, became part of a group of Brit actors like Ian Ogilvy, etc., who were sort of there, but never quite managed to get to the next level, I feel.
Well, I think it, you know, it is difficult when you're doing, at least at that time, when you were doing what was seen as, you know, genre pieces. I think it was hard to be taken seriously. I mean, people have a hard time remembering now what an extraordinary occasion it was for Marlon Brando to appear in Superman. That until then, these kind of superhero and big adventure movies, these were not serious films. And it wasn't until you had Glenn Ford and Marlon Brando, whose names appear above the title, ahead of Christopher Reeve in Superman, till you have Gene Hackman in these, that it suddenly became okay for adults to take these kind of movies seriously. And I think, therefore, that Michael York kind of gets dismissed because of that. And it is a shame because there is so much, as we're doing here, but so much interesting material to look at in his filmography. I do love two things, you know, especially apropos of this being part of a scholarly seminar looking at these films. But when Logan is being told of this assignment by the computer, and he has his clock moved forward so that he can be believably a runner, where people can believe that he would sacrifice his life as a Sandman and become a runner, and he's desperate to find out if he will get his 4 years back. And I don't know if this is true in the UK, but there are many of us who are the product of educational systems here in the US where we wish we could get our 4 years back.
Let's consider a few of the other names and actors who were involved with that. I would be remiss of us not to include the voice of Roscoe Lee Brown, of course, as the voice of Box, somebody who, again, that wonderful notion of sea greens and plankton by the sea and the creation of the robotic, apparently very friendly individual, but less so. The first real alternative character we're introduced to, the robotic non-human form, when, of course, Jessica and Logan are kind of partly getting out of the city.
Well, yes, he comes at the end of in the beginning of the second half of the film, and shortly after Logan has truly become a runner, because he's pretending to be a runner, although it sure seems like he's becoming more emotionally involved. But we know that even after he and Jessica have escaped through the love shop, and again, a wonderful message about how freedom from both death and life can be attained for short periods of time as time slows down through physical love. But he does not become a runner at that point. After all, he still signals the Sandman right before meeting the protectors of Sanctuary in the shadows. And boy, they embody the Watchers symbol that dates back to the origin of all secret societies. And literally, these Watcher symbols represent the birth of consciousness itself. So that's, you know, incredibly interesting that this path that Logan is on is one of actually achieving consciousness. And sure enough, after the confrontation between the Sandman and the Watchers, where the Watchers all seemingly are killed, but Logan himself kills a Sandman, at that point he crosses the Rubicon. And much like Forbidden Planet, which this film is evocative of for me, both in terms of the robot character that you just described, and this descent into the somewhat mechanical, submerged ancient civilization beneath the surface, in this case full of leaky pipes and water, we're venturing down into the disowned subconscious, where where the path to consciousness must go. It must always go through the subconscious and through the relics of past worlds and past lives that we all contain within us, at least in our dreams, if not in our DNA. And then by elevating up into the cold, icy, idealized realm, which is guarded by, in human realm, the all-seeing third eye, in this case, embodied really by the Roscoe Lee Brown robot character, who says that he is more than machine or man, and more than a fusion of the two. Indeed, he is a robot who is feasting on frozen humanity. And this is what we are cautioned when we are seeking enlightenment, when human beings throughout history have sought enlightenment. This is what we are cautioned against, that when you access that all-seeing third eye, it is really this place past humanity. It is a coldness to that kind of enlightenment. So although it is necessary to achieve it, it is necessary, like Siddhartha when he became the Buddha, like the Christ, we must return to our humanity in order to teach the lessons that we have found. And only by returning to humanity is Logan able to become what we believe to be the first person to actually achieve the outside world. And as you pointed out earlier, see the sun, see the warmth.
People who are downloading this podcast, it's worth reminding them that they're listening to a consideration of a series of classic science fiction movies. The first one, of course, in the series is Logan's Run. They're being screened at the MTech building at the University of Lincoln. And, of course, you can always access them yourself and use the podcast to actually enjoy it yourself via DVDs and various other factors. Looking back at the time and looking at some of the characters that were there, we mentioned Roscoe Lee Brown, of course. It's probably something which, for folk of a certain generation, the words Farrah Fawcett Majors would encompass Charlie's Angels, although she was only in it for one season. Certainly the fact that she was married to Lee Majors, the $6 million man, and she was very much the poster girl for an awful long period of the 70s, sort of evocative of the culture post-Watergate, Jimmy Carter scenario. And this was one of, I think, a series where she kind of almost managed to make a reasonable career for herself, etc. Never quite made it as big as perhaps what we'd anticipated in certain instances. She went on, of course, to star with Kirk Douglas in Saturn III and a number of other sort of areas. But she does have a role here. It's more than a cameo, but less than perhaps a starring role. I think one of the questions that was put on social media was, how did she actually merit the sort of star status within that? Possibly because she was Farrah Fawcett.
Well, I believe 76 is the year that Charlie's Angels premieres on television. So it is probably, I mean, we would have to, you know, probably dig on release dates. But one would imagine that either Charlie's Angels had premiered prior to the release of Logan's Run, or certainly it had been picked up for production. So the producers of Logan's Run quite savvily understood that with a lead in a forthcoming network television series, it wouldn't hurt to give her upfront billing, significant billing. And indeed, it is one of the reasons that the film is remembered. But it's also, I think, again, one of these wonderful synchronicities where Farrah Fawcett herself, throughout her career, but especially in the 1970s, embodied this uncomfortable, at times, relationship between the emerging feminism and traditional storytelling ideals. Charlie's Angels, right, is a show where the women are fulfilling, though, traditionally masculine roles. They are the private detectives. They are, or the undercover detectives. They are bringing the criminals to justice. The men are supportive to them. So it is forward thinking in that way. But as you put it, yes, all the eye candy and the objectification is still very much in place. So it's this uneasy combination at times, and certainly that's true in Logan's Run as well, because although there is this ongoing conversation about the role of the masculine versus the feminine, the women are certainly, we get to have our cake and eat it too. We get to applaud the forward-thinking themes and morals being expressed by the movie, while at the same time getting to see half-naked women prance about the screen.
Indeed.
The whole time.
Well, they had to. I mean, obviously, get out of those wet clothes as soon as possible. It's a classic line. Every sense of the word.
Well, and I also love that, you know, as soon as we've, you know, we have emerged from the frozen wasteland where Roscoe Lee Brown's robot character is holding all of the fleeing runners in an icy hibernation, that once Logan and Jessica emerge into the world and see the sun, only then are the characters able to return to nature and explore their own nature to find out what it means to be human. And the road leads us to Washington, D.C., which, of course, is an immediately recognizable symbol of power, symbol of the new world, symbol of you know, aspirations of liberty and equality. But what do we see that denotes it as Washington, D.C., upon first viewing? It's the Washington Memorial, which is nothing less than the most gigantic phallus symbol mankind has ever, if you'll pardon the phrase, erected.
Indeed.
And that's not a coincidence. So what it shows is that that kind of expression of liberty and equality, a purely masculinized version of it, is eventually going to get overgrown by our true natures. And our true natures are going to have to be one of real equality between men and women, which Logan and Jessica do represent.
Phil, we've talked a huge amount about dreams, about analysis, about deep textual analysis within the whole thing. We need to begin to draw a few conclusions together for this. A few quick questions, if I may. First of all, what did you make of the Richard Jordan character, Francis? So obviously, Logan and Francis were best buds, as we see at the start. I mean, admittedly, Francis is prone to actually set off alarms in the nursery and be a little bit more testy. In the end, was there a sadness when we see the demise of Francis, who is doggedly, almost in a fugitive-esque way, pursued Logan and Jessica as the ideal company man, you might well say, saying he's going to sort the things out and so on? Or do we sort of have a sense of regret that somehow he's made the wrong choice?
Well, you know, Francis plagued me a great deal after I rewatched this film, to be honest with you, partly because Richard Jordan is a fantastic actor who died way too young, and I had forgotten that it was him in the movie. But the name Francis, again, is very interesting because its origin means Frenchman, and of course, so much of our idea of liberty in this country is a gift of the French. And of course, one of the great stories about a runner comes to us and is a French origin story.
Les Miserables.
There's a reference there. But what's interesting, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but when the name Francis was exported to these shores, it took on a new meaning. And so if an American is named Francis, that name literally means free. And so Francis is such a touching character to me because he can't embrace his true nature, which is to be free. And you have to love, again, in the prescient commentary not only on 1970s political culture, but on where our culture was heading, that the climactic battle, the climactic fight, would take place in the People's House of the U.S. Congress. A place where, indeed, ideals are supposed to be expressed and embodied, but instead a place that descends into simply fighting, into violence, where ultimately the flag itself is used as a weapon. And speaking as an American, and as an American who has witnessed the last quarter century or more of the flag being used as a weapon, it's hard not to see the prescient nature of the storytellers behind Logan's Run.
We haven't had a chance to really speak about the children, the cubs in Cathedral. Again, another religious reference that comes through with that. Or indeed the sort of ending of the movie where Peter Ustinov, after originally feeling as though he was going to be left behind, is taken on there. And the very almost fairy tale-esque ending and the sort of tentative touchings of the wrinkles. We kind of leave it there after the city has actually exploded. Almost begging a sequel to be made. People have often talked about either a remake or a sequel, etc. Do you feel this is one of those texts which should be left alone, considered in its own entirety? Or, as we've seen, I mean, the latest incarnation was 2010, when I think Blue Water actually came up with Logan's Run Last Day. Do you think it's inevitable that the nature of the business being that, you know, we will see some incarnation of Logan's Run emerging?
Well, there's been talk of it for a long time. I know Bryan Singer had always wanted to do a Logan's Run film. I wouldn't say that, you know, they shouldn't. Of course, I always take the point of view that any remake, any reboot, only calls attention to an original. It only advertises the original, so that's good. But also, I think there could be a way to explore it. Certainly, it took a long time, but Rise of the Planet of the Apes was a worthy heir, finally, to the original Planet of the Apes. But I wouldn't think a continuation story, and I'll tell you why. It goes back to how beautifully the themes get closed in Logan's Run. You know, you mentioned the Cubs and the Cathedral. There's a wonderful explicit line, "I wish I'd known my mother." Well, the mother is a way of also thinking of the church, is it not? Our church as our mother. And so you see the danger of youth not knowing its mother, literally living in the cathedral but not knowing the words of its mother church, becoming wild, becoming violent, not ever being able to be integrated into society. There are, according to the computer, 1,056 runners unaccounted for. Again, how can any number that specific be a coincidence? In numerology, 1056 resonates with creation, new beginnings, striving towards achieving new goals, new things, towards self-reliance, determination, intuition, initiative. That's what the number represents. That's where we end our story, with Logan leading the populace of the city towards exploring these very ideas. It is about a new beginning. And getting back to my terrible joke about how 4 years of university I wish I could get back, it isn't a coincidence that Logan is concerned about getting his 4 years back, because after all, it took Christ himself roughly 4 years to achieve his ministry, if you include his crucifixion, his resurrection, his ascension. Logan will not get his 4 years back, but he will enter a world where, in the words of Peter Ustinov, he is simply as old as he is old.
And in the biblical reference, of course, the sequence when Logan and Jessica return to the city and the lines, "No one has to die at 30, you could live, live, live and grow old." Very John the Baptist-esque in terms of preaching that. Of course, Peter Ustinov, you could say, who better than to actually have the Old Testament prophet, basically?
Yes, absolutely. I did not know that bit of casting. And that is incredibly telling, is it not? But I always liked the phrase, you know, don't count the days you have left, make the days you have left count. And that is, if nothing else, what Logan's Run is expressing. And it's also why I love getting to take parts in conversations like this very one, Alex Lefchuk, because I really feel like I am making my days count.
It's been a pleasure and a privilege to actually share some thoughts with you. Of course, you'll be returning for 2001 A Space Odyssey, a whole range of wonderful things there. I think from the Department of Great Last Lines with Farrah Fawcett in her character's Holly. Holly's line, "Will you get on the table, please? Logan, do you need me to take my clothes off? Not for your face," responds Holly. Still like that, even now. Phil, many thanks, and as we said, we'll speak again with respect to 2001 and possibly more as well.
Excellent. Look forward to it. Thank you so much for letting me be a part of this.